WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. My guest, Marcel Ofels, directed one of the classic documentaries of our time, The Sorrow and the Pity. That controversial 1971 film about French collaboration with the Nazis during World War II was banned by French television for 9 years. It was about a subject that Ofels knew firsthand. His father, the German-Jewish film director Max Ofels, had taken the family out of Germany in 1933. They fled to Paris. In 1941, they had to leave France to again escape the Nazis. They ended up in Hollywood. As an adult, Marcel Ofels has gone back to France and Germany to explore the history of the Nazis in his documentaries. The Memory of Justice looked at the hypocrisies of the Nuremberg trials, and Hotel Terminus was about former Gestapo chief Klaus Barbie. It won an Academy Award. Ofels' new film, November Days, is a look at life in Eastern Europe since the fall of the Berlin Wall. A retrospective of Marcel Ofels' films is being featured at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, which opens in New York this week. The idea for November Days didn't come from Ofels. He was asked to direct it for the BBC.
I never wanted to do any of these films. No, really. I never volunteer. I mean, it's like the army used to be in World War II. You know, the good advice that top sergeants used to give to you, never volunteer for anything. I'm not in the habit of volunteering for documentary films. For one thing, they're very strenuous and not particularly easy to make. And also the pay is not all that good.
So you don't choose your film projects?
Never.
Someone makes you do them?
Well, I have film projects that I want to do, but somehow it gets more difficult as the years go by. Also, you become typecast, and you're happy when somebody comes up with some sort of suggestion and money. And someone like the BBC that gives you work. And then it's once you're in the saddle that the project becomes your own and that you then try to lead the horse you want to, the way you want to lead it and get it to the finishing line.
In the beginning of your latest film, November Days, you ask a man on such a night, and this is the night, and we see people celebrating the collapse of the wall. We see the smiles, the tears, all the elation. And you ask a man, on such a night, does liberation also mean sex?
Right.
And I was so struck by that question. It really stayed with me through the whole film.
Oh, good.
And I was very curious why you asked him that.
Well, I'll tell you. It's because I was very much aware of this being sent into Germany for this particular project by the English, and that one of the reasons they had thought of me is that I'm not a German, that I'm the son of a German Jew, and that we are French. And so it was very much in my mind that the first thing we should try to do is to impress on an international audience, on an English audience, French audience too eventually, that Germans, no matter what their past may be, are people like other people. And the best way to do that is to show that occasionally they screw.
Just as simple as that.
Sure. It also had to do with my French editor who said, well, why do you want, we want to show these people, you know, being so happy and drinking champagne and why all this euphoria about some wall coming down? After all, they're Germans, you know, the hereditary enemy. So this was a way of convincing him that he's wrong.
Well, there's another scene, and I think perhaps it's connected to that same sensibility, and you're talking to a young East German waiter and asking him how he's going to celebrate the wall, and he says, I don't know. I don't know how to dance, or I feel shy and awkward. And I thought that really spoke volumes about him, but also volumes about the system that he lived under, that he seemed not to know or believe that he could express this real elation.
Yes, it's an inferiority complex, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's been, apparently it's been getting stronger and stronger since. I haven't really been back into that situation, but the feeling of inadequacy and the feeling of inequality and the arrogance of some of the West Germans who, because they have had the benefits of the free world for all these many years because when Hitler's downfall came, they happened to be on the right side of the fence. These differences have now become even greater. The East Germans feel shakier and shakier, and so that waiter really does indeed, I think, he must be about 16, 17, 18 years old, and he's only referring to rock music and how can you get on a dance floor with nice Berlin girls and try to make them, again we get to sex, when you really feel that inadequate because you haven't had these privileges of freedom.
And then you go on and it's painful to watch. The camera rests and you watch him just trying to do a kind of a soft shoe dance, and he looks so awkward. I found it very painful to watch.
Really?
Yeah, I felt really? For him
I
somehow.
I think he's a fairly good dancer. Really? Oh well.
Maybe I'm showing my age. I don't know.
No, well, I don't know how old you are, but the music, of course, is not rock, which is the music that he would dance to. The music is Fred Astaire, which is the music that I like. So that's very arbitrary, of course.
My guest today is Marcel Ofels, and he, of course, is the maker of a number of very famous documentaries, including The Sorrow and the Pity, Hotel Terminus, The Memory of Justice, and his latest documentary is called November Days, and it's a look at life behind the Iron Curtain and the changes underway in Europe since the fall of the Berlin Wall. In this latest film, you juxtapose present-day footage, interviews, with footage from a number of musicals. And there's even a point in this documentary where you burst into song and you sing, "It's wonderful, it's marvelous."
It's wonderful,
just like
it's marvelous, you should care for me.
Are you?
It's Gershwin. It's yes. One of his greatest tunes.
Well, I'm wondering how frustrated you are in trying to make a musical yourself as a filmmaker.
Well, I don't think musicals. It was always my ambition. I mean, I'm a song and dance man and comedy, and I was trained in that. I was an assistant director. I'm also my father's son, who didn't do nearly enough comedies because in real life he was the funniest man I ever met. But his specialty were more romantic movies because also he never always did what he wanted to do, which isn't really that important. But the thing about musical comedy, Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly, you can't do anymore. They aren't around anymore, and the audience for it isn't around anymore. Because rock music, I think, has, just as television has destroyed the landscape that great filmmaking art has to cope with, that has been, to a great extent, destroyed by sitcoms. Just in the same way, if jazz musicians were really candid in front of a microphone or when they're being interviewed, most of them would say that rock music and the synthesizer has destroyed Broadway and musicals and the basis of Broadway and musicals, which of course is jazz and black jazz, we don't really have the audience for that anymore. So that is sort of useless nostalgia. Has nothing to do with reality anymore.
Let me read something that you wrote in American Film, and this was back in 1985. And you said, "Documentaries are just not my favorite kind of movie watching. The fact is that I don't trust the little bastards. I don't trust the motives of those who think they are superior to fiction films. I don't trust their claim to have cornered the market on the truth. I don't trust their inordinately high and entirely undeserved status of bourgeois respectability. Most of all, I dislike the idea of the greatest of all popular art forms ever being shanghaied into the service of a cause." Any cause. When I read that, I thought, well, then how am I supposed to view Marcel Ophüls' films? Is he saying, don't trust me and don't trust what I'm saying in this film?
No, basically, I guess I'm saying don't trust the others.
Just trust you.
You know, I don't know why this reminds me of that. My father used to say, why should I go see the movies? Why should I go see other people's movies? If the movie's bad, I'm bored. If the movie's good, I'm jealous. I'm just listening to you just now. I thought, my God, yes, I would still subscribe to all of that. It's the idea that we should teach, that movies should teach. Howard Hughes, I think, once said something very wise. He said, "If you want to send a message, use Western Union."
I'm speaking with Marcel Ophüls, and his latest documentary is called November Days, and it's a look behind the Iron Curtain and a film that is part of the 1992 Human Rights Watch Film Festival, which debuts in New York City on May 8th, and it's beginning a national tour. Marcel Ophüls also, of course, did The Sorrow and the Pity, Hotel Terminus, The Memory of Justice. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with filmmaker Marcel Ophüls. Is there a trick, have you found over the many years that you've been getting people to talk? Is there a trick to get people to talk to you?
Well, you get me to talk.
Yeah?
Is there a trick?
Well, for me, it does involve a certain amount of research.
Yes, of course.
And a lot of nodding. You can't see that, but I nod.
Yes, of course. Well, that's you see, you're supplying the part of the answer. I think the worst mistake that you can make, whether it's with an old Nazi or whether it's with a politician or with a university professor or with anybody, is to seem to be following some sort of script and not reacting to the last answer. Mm-hmm. I think the ideal interview is one where it becomes a conversation because you react to what people are telling you as they go along. That's one thing. And the other thing, of course, the thing to avoid is to be uninformed. In other words, if the person you're interviewing gets the feeling that you haven't been doing your homework, then she or he is not going to be terribly forthcoming.
Is there a way to get an old Nazi to talk or a way to get someone to talk whose ideas you actually want to denounce or whose ideas you want to expose?
Yes, well, I seem to be the specialist of that particular situation.
Yes.
And lately, I didn't know the answer for a long time and maybe I still don't know it. There is one thing, I think, which old Nazis or even young Nazis, and I have in common for very, very different reasons. But we are interested in the past. And most people are not. And this gives us something to talk about. And one of the recipes, I don't know if it works every time, but one of the recipes is to announce who you are. One of the things is to make quite clear that I'm Jewish, that because I'm Jewish, I'm not likely to agree with anything he has to say. And make that quite clear from the beginning, and then you usually find that not only do they want to justify themselves, which is one way of talking, but at the end they would like to open a bottle of champagne and have a feast of reconciliation with you. It's that last part that I usually don't cooperate in. But because that's off camera anyway, so why should you do it?
Well, are you working against this desire, whether it's an individual's desire or a nation's desire, to forget about the past? A kind of amnesia that can just sort of like a fog, make the past disappear.
Yes, it's not a sense of mission, but because it's the nature of the work. If I'm going to be doing that kind of work, I have to constantly appeal to people's faulty, fragmentary memories, to their selective memory, and to try to make my own selection out of their own selective memory. Mm. My own, too, because I'm 64 years old and my own memory is getting bad. I got knocked over the head on the way back from Bolivia on the Barbie thing, and probably by some of the Bolivian goons on Copacabana Beach, and I haven't been the same since. I now need help in the editing room just to keep 120 hours of film together and repertory it and put it in cross-index it so that we can all shape our memories together.
Let me just make sure I understand what you just said. And you mentioned the fact of getting beaten up in Bolivia. Can you tell us what happened?
It wasn't in Bolivia. It was on the way back from Bolivia where we had been filming the South American episode of the film The Life and Times of Klaus Barbie. And Barbie's former friends, neighbors, and protectors, of course, knew about the film. And they were at that time not officially in power, but they were still the owners of Bolivian Airlines, and they were still in charge of much of the Secret Service and the goon squads and so forth. And after the filming itself was fairly easy. The hotel where we were filming, I understand, was full of microphones because Hugo Banzer, who was Barbie's main protector, owned the hotel, actually. So by the time I got back to Rio, I'd never been in Rio. I went there mostly because of Fred Astaire and flying down to Rio, and because it seemed a romantic place to be, and a weekend in Copacabana. I mean, I don't get down to South America very frequently. And by that time, the briefcase with all the documents and the names of the dissidents that I had been interviewing had disappeared. And the beach was there was nobody on the beach except somebody, some man selling grapes. And it was off season. And I went surfing, you know, and the waves are very big on Copacabana Beach. And that's the last thing I remember. And I woke up with a bloody face on the Avenida in front of the Meridian Hotel about half an hour later, and some Brazilian kid was speaking to me in Portuguese and pointing to my face and saying that it was bloody. And then later on, 2 weeks later or 3 weeks later, I had a small operation, very harmless operation in Paris, and now I've got a sort of a hole in my head. And the assumption is, although we can't be sure, that these were indeed goons. It was the Bolivian goons who hit me over the head. Anyway, the whole point, I guess, is that I do have this reputation now of being Mr. Memory, like the 39 steps of Hitchcock, Mr. Memory. And Mr. Memory has no memory.
That means that it's a memory you can't exactly trust because It comes
I have to shepherd it. I have to nurse it. I have to have people who work with me in the editing room, who do cross-indexing, which should be done anyway. Computers help. It's a matter of, you know, when you have 120 hours of interviews to deal with, it's mostly a feat of memory anyway. And now I have people whom I trust who help me along. Mm. But going to parties, for instance, is usually embarrassing because people I met 10 years before and so forth, I may not. Part of it, I suppose, is the aging process.
Your father left Germany in the 30s, before the war.
Yes, 33, the day after the Reichstag fire. In other words, the day after Hitler took over, practically.
Do you have any memories of Germany, of your childhood?
I remember leaving. I remember the kitchen floor when we were in, and the small car that drove us to the station was a two-seater and open. My father was always a very frivolous man. He always had what do you call them, convertibles, very chic convertibles, and two-seaters. And I was back with the luggage, and we drove to the station and just got in onto a Pullman, what do you call him, a wagon-lit sleeper to Paris. All he had to do was take his luggage along because being a genius, he didn't need to sell a lot of property.
So much of your documentaries have had to do with Germany, with certainly The Sorrow and the Pity, Hotel Terminus, The Memory of Justice. Do you think these films are in some way a memory to your own father and what he did and sort of where he came from and his leaving of Germany?
Yes. Yes, I think that's perfectly true. I think that's true. It's something that's not always understood because people have this idea that my father, because his specialty was costume films and so-called romantic films, and they're not really romantic, they're very realistic, but that he was somehow above politics. But obviously, leading the life that he did in the century that we live in and having the destiny that he had, he couldn't possibly be an intelligent man. He couldn't possibly be unpolitical. And at home, of course, we talked much more about politics than we ever talked about movies. We had good reason to. And yes, it does have to do with the idea that being cosmopolitan, which is now supposed to be a bad thing to be again because of the rise of nationalism, that being a cosmopolitan gives you a view of other people's aspirations and other people's culture and a sort of distance to it, which might be something that can be used in not only in a critical way, but also in a generous way. My father was a very generous man.
Marcel Ofel's latest documentary is called November Days. It will be shown as part of a retrospective of his films at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival, which opens this week in New York City. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.